Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 30th of April, these are our main stories. Sudan's army says it's launching a major assault on Khartoum with heavy weapons to try to dislodge a rival militia force there. Police in Texas say they believe the latest mass gun attack happened when a family asked a man to end his shooting practice nearby to allow their baby to get to sleep. And a Ukrainian intelligence official says a huge fire in the Russian-occupied port of Sevastopol has destroyed 40,000 tons of oil products. Also in this podcast.
It's really nice, but it's a little sad too. I've seen a lot of people in the audience today in tears, so it's obviously something that means a lot to a lot of people.
A sculpture is unveiled in Norway in memory of Freya the walrus. And we begin in Sudan. As we record this podcast, the violence seems to be escalating. The army said on Saturday that it had launched a large-scale attack from all directions on the capital, Khartoum, in an effort to recapture areas held by the rival Rapid Support Forces. It has urged people to remain indoors and stay away from windows as it deploys tanks and other artillery, in spite of a declared ceasefire. Against this background, the government of South Sudan says it's still trying to convene peace talks between representatives of the two sides. Our Africa regional editor is Will Ross.
It certainly looks as though things are escalating. There are some reports of heavy fighting in downtown Khartoum, some reports saying near the presidential palace and the army headquarters. Difficult to confirm, but certainly throughout Saturday there were plumes of dark smoke rising, and earlier on we had heard of the Rapid Support Force positions in the capital being bombed from the air by the military, and some anti-aircraft fire in the other direction. We've also had some statements from the two sides. The army has just put one out saying that 10 brigades of the army are invading the capital, a large-scale operation they're talking about coming from all directions. Again, hard for us to verify, but that's what they say. They're also telling people in Khartoum to stay indoors, to stay away from windows, because they're going to use heavy artillery, including tanks. The Rapid Support Forces are saying that the army is also deploying a notorious police unit, which was people kind of expected this unit to come in, but that's another sign of probably of the whole conflict escalating, and certainly that the battle for Khartoum seems to be going up a notch. And you know, all talk of a ceasefire completely null and void now. There's nobody clearly from either side that's even mentioning it.
And in the meantime, what about diplomatic efforts, external international diplomatic efforts to try to calm everything down?
Well, the South Sudanese government, and it was South Sudan that had offered to host representatives from the two sides, it's put out a statement, foreign ministry there, saying that it's continuing to try and talk to both sides and convince them that the only way through this is, first of all, a ceasefire to allow humanitarian access, but also stop the war through dialogue. And we've had some very interesting comments earlier on Saturday from the former Prime Minister of Sudan, Abdallah Hamdok, who painted a very bleak picture of what's going on and said really the only solution is a unified international approach to trying to get the negotiations to happen. In other words, there's no point in the African Union, the UN, Russia, the UAE, all different countries trying different approaches. They need one message, and that's to both sides to sit down and talk. And Mr. Hamdok said there can be no winners in this war. He was actually speaking in an event hosted by Mo Ibrahim, the billionaire Sudanese businessman. And Mr. Ibrahim had some extremely strong words. He described the two generals on the rival sides as crazy. And he said they are intoxicated by power and money. Each of them think they can become the new Bashir. So referring to the former president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, who's in power for nearly three decades and is wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
That was Will Ross. Well, tens of thousands of people have been uprooted within Sudan. Many foreigners have managed to escape on flights operated by their national governments. Thousands of others have had to embark on arduous road trips to neighbouring Chad, Egypt, South Sudan and Ethiopia. This Sudanese citizen arriving at Abu Dhabi International Airport in the UAE said they had been terrified.
There was fire in the street, fire in the houses, in the cars. After two, 3 days from that, the RSF, they start to have shortage of food, water and power. So they start to invade homes.
Civilians who've travelled by land crossing the border into Egypt have told the BBC that refugees are being exploited, with reports that some bus operators are charging 20 times more than usual for the journey from Khartoum. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman reports from the town of Aswan in southern Egypt.
They carry the shock of survivors who got away with their lives but lost everything else. And yet, Sudan's refugees face further dispossession. A row breaks out about a minibus fare involving one of the men who brought evacuees over from Khartoum. This stop has become a hub in the Egyptian desert for those heading to Cairo, and there's no sign of aid groups here, only refugees having to fend for themselves. I meet Husna, who got here before the fighting started. Her teenage daughters are still trapped in Khartoum, so the man who runs the bus stop tea shop gave Husna a job, the kindness of a stranger. She's trying to earn enough to pay for her girls' tickets to escape Sudan. I couldn't bring my daughters here and I can't return to them. The bus ticket to bring them now costs $250,000 Sudanese pounds, says Husna. In an aid vacuum, those trying to escape the Sudanese capital are at growing risk of exploitation. Husna's numbers suggest the men running the routes have hiked up prices 20-fold due to the demand to escape. A full bus of refugees would now make its operators more than $21,000. My daughters saw an artillery shell fall in our neighbourhood. I don't have a husband or a son to help them. I work day in, day out to save money and send it to them, says Husna.
And are you able to talk to them? Have you been in touch?
Yes, I call them regularly. They tell me they lie under the bed, unable to go out and buy food. Sudan is completely destroyed, says Husna.
Tom Bateman reporting from southern Egypt. In recent days, around 2,000 people have arrived in the Saudi coastal city of Jeddah after being evacuated from Port Sudan in the east of the country. People from more than 70 countries are now reported to have arrived there. There's been another mass shooting in the United States. Police in Texas say five people, including an eight-year-old boy, have been killed at a house in the town of Cleveland. This local resident was in shock.
When I heard the shooting, we were in bed and my kids, I have two babies, they got scared. But we're like, well, that's normal, they're always shooting. They're always calling the cops and there's nothing done for that. But I thought it was like a normal day.
The suspected shooter is armed with an assault rifle and is still on the run. Our correspondent Jessica Parker told us what happened.
This happened on Friday night in a town called Cleveland, which is about 45 miles northeast of Houston in Texas. And according to the local sheriff, who's been talking to local media over the course of the day, he says that the victims approached their neighbour who had been firing a rifle, in his front yard and asked him to stop doing that because they were trying to get a baby to sleep. Police have also said that this person is known to have done this before in the local area. Now, following this, a shooting unfolded in the house of the victims, and very sadly, five people have died, including an eight-year-old boy. He was taken to hospital but didn't survive. Four other people died as well, among them two women who were found in a room lying on top of two other children who did survive. And officers have said they believe those women may have been trying to protect those children who, as I say, did survive. but they describe a pretty horrific scene, and the local sheriff has talked about how it appeared to be a kind of execution-style shooting with the victims shot in the head. So very horrifying details are coming out of this. The victims, all believed to be from Honduras, around 10 people had been in the household at the time, 5 of those, of course, now deceased.
And at this point, I understand that the suspect is still at large as we speak now. What do we know about him?
So the suspect, according to police, is of Mexican nationality. They know who he is, reportedly in his late 30s. A manhunt underway for him, and an update provided on that by the local sheriff, Greg Capers.
We know that he shot a .223, which is AR-15 style weapon, and we know him to be about 10 to 12 miles away from here at this particular time.
Is the debate about gun ownership shifting in any way in the US?
Every time there is a mass shooting, and there have been already, research suggests, over 170 this year alone, mass shootings have been on the rise in recent years, there is this kind of renewed discussion. So there is, I think, only really a consensus that gun violence does need to be tackled, but how that happens, those divisions just seem to persist, and as I say, seem just quite entrenched, and you don't see much movement in terms of that debate after tragedies like this.
Jessica Parker. Poland has seized control of a building in Warsaw, which Russian diplomats use as a school for their children. Poland says it's state-owned property and they have a legal right to it. The Russians insist the building is theirs and that Poland has broken a major international treaty by taking it. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss gave us the background to the story.
This saga has been going on for a year, in fact, but it looks like it has now reached its climax. Yes, Poland says the building is state-owned. A bit of confusion because some people are quoting a foreign ministry spokesman saying it's owned by the city of Warsaw. Others say it's owned by Poland nationally. Either way, not owned by Russia, Poland says. Nonsense, says Russia. They say they own it, that diplomats use it for their children. But more importantly, they say this is a diplomatic building. It means, basically, like the Russian embassy itself, it's effectively sacrosanct. This goes to the Vienna Convention of 1961. I can quote you Article 22. It says the premises of a diplomatic mission are inviolable, must not be entered by the host country. The host country must never search the premises and must protect the mission. Well, Poland clearly doesn't think it applies to this building. Police apparently entered it on Saturday morning. They told the staff there they had to leave by 7 that evening and they had till the end of the week to pick up any equipment. Now, Russia is furious about this. The country's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, promised a strong response. And listening to her statement, I have to say she does sound a bit like an angry head teacher herself.
Such an impudent move by Warsaw, which goes beyond the framework of civilized interstate communication, will not remain without our harsh reaction and consequences for the Polish authorities and Poland's interests in Russia. This needs to be understood by the initiators of such controversial and provocative undertakings.
So, Paul, what does this all say about Russia-Poland relations right now?
Well, clearly, this dispute is about much more than a building. It's about more than where Russian diplomats' children learn their ABC and their multiplication tables. I might add, by the way, that the building itself really is remarkably ugly. This is not a fight over some grand palatial structure. It looks like the worst that 1970s communist architecture had to offer. So why such bad feelings? Well, Poland and Russia have never had a great relationship. If you go back in history, the Soviet Union effectively occupied Poland after World War II with a communist government installed. Things got much worse last year after Russia attacked Ukraine. Poland became one of the staunchest supporters of Ukraine. In fact, more than $1 billion of aid they've given, including MiG fighter jets. And soon after the invasion, Poland expelled 45 Russian diplomats who they said were working for Russian intelligence. Now, I should say lots of countries have expelled Russian diplomats in the past year, very much the in thing to do, but 45 was one of the largest numbers. All in all, it's safe to say that Russia's relations with Poland were already not great. This row over the school can only make it worse. And I think we'll have to see what kind of retribution Ms. Zakharova and her Russian foreign ministry colleagues have in store.
That was Paul Moss. A Ukrainian intelligence official has said that 40,000 tons of oil products were destroyed by a fire in Russian-occupied Crimea. The blaze broke out in the port city of Sevastopol, home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. Our correspondent Hugo Bechega is monitoring events from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
It was a massive blaze, and it took hours for firefighters to contain it. The site, an oil terminal in the strategic port of Sevastopol, home to the Russian Navy's Black Sea Fleet. The city's Russian-appointed governor described it as a drone attack carried out by the enemy. Russian officials frequently put the blame for incidents in Crimea on Ukraine. Here in Kyiv, there's a strategy of ambiguity. No confirmation of involvement, no denial. Reacting to the fire, a Ukrainian intelligence official reportedly said it was God's punishment for a Russian missile that hit a block of flats, killing 23 people. Crimea is the Ukrainian peninsula that Russia annexed in 2014 and that Ukraine has vowed to recapture. This alleged attack happens as the Ukrainian authorities say they're finishing plans for an offensive to try to take back occupied territory.
Hugo Bechega. Still to come.
So nostalgic. I'm feeling so emotional. You guys are such an important part of my life and such an important reason for why I'm actually here.
Why this man was so moved to make it onto the BBC World Service programme, Sports World. We'll be right back after this.
15 years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And we're back. A sea of Turkish flags in the port city of Izmir. Thousands gathered for the return of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to the campaign trail.
Sevgili İzmirliler, başımızın tacı kıymetli hanımefendiler.
Mr. Erdogan was making his first public appearances since illness forced him out of the spotlight. With 2 weeks to go, the presidential race is on a knife edge. The BBC's Orla Girin is in Izmir. So how did Mr. Erdogan look during Saturday's rally?
I mean, he looked well, and I think that will have reassured his supporters, possibly not his critics. He appeared on stage and the crowd had been waiting for hours under a hot sun. And there was a huge cheer when he arrived. He spoke for almost 40 minutes. He was on his feet for the entire time. He was combative. He was fiery. He mocked the opposition. He raised the spectre of terrorism. And he said that only he could deliver growth for Turkey. Now, the location today was significant because Izmir, which is Turkey's third largest city, is a stronghold of the opposition. And in fact, tomorrow, in exactly the same location in the city, there will be a rally by the president's main rival for the presidency, the secular challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. So he will be gathering his supporters in the same place. It'll be interesting to see when that rally takes place, which had the larger crowd. Certainly, as far as the opinion polls are concerned, Kılıçdaroğlu has a narrow lead, but it really is very narrow. And the expectation here is that it will definitely go to a second round on the 28th of May. And many people are expecting a photo finish.
And at that rally, how was the atmosphere? Did Mr. Erdogan's supporters seem relieved?
I think they were. We spoke to one woman who was a 42-year-old mother of two, and I asked her how she had felt when she heard that he was unwell. And she said, when I heard, I asked God to give me his illness. She said, I'm ready to be in pain for him because he gives us everything. It was a very upbeat gathering, I would say. A lot of rock music, a lot of warm-up acts, as you might have at a music festival. But certainly a lot of die-hard Erdogan supporters who have voted for the president through all his 20 years in power and who say they will continue to do so despite the great economic difficulty that Turkey is in, despite the rampant inflation and despite the complaints about the government's slow response to the devastating earthquakes back in February. So President Erdogan will need each and every every vote that he can get. And it was noticeable today that this was a segregated gathering. Women were on one side, men were on the other. And his bedrock support is religious conservatives who share his vision of Turkey. His problem and the problem for his supporters is that there are many here who don't want that vision anymore.
Ola Girin in Turkey. Now, sounds from the centre of the Afghan capital on Saturday. A group of women protesting in Kabul in defiance of a crackdown on dissent, urging the international community not to recognise the Taliban government. So far, no country has recognised the government as legitimate, but there have been suggestions that the first steps towards this could be taken at a United Nations summit this week in Doha. Our reporter Zia Shahriar told us more.
More than a dozen Afghan women showed up on the street of Kabul, where we know that there are a lot of restrictions by the Taliban, and they were protesting against the Taliban's restriction. They were chanting against any efforts to probably recognize the Taliban or any international recognition of the Taliban. And they were walking in the center of Kabul in the streets, where it's very difficult for women to walk, to come up and to get together. It's been after, I think, a few months now, 3-4 months, that these women are able to get out and to protest against the Taliban. We know that in the past, the Taliban have arrested them. The Taliban have repressed these sort of protests, have really used violent means to stop women to come to the streets. And it really takes a lot of courage for these women to come out and to protest against the Taliban. And we know that a few of these activists have been arrested in the past, put into prison, and even tortured by the Taliban. But still, these women were there to express their views. They were asking for the international community to help the Afghan women, to put pressure on the Taliban. They were chanting that the Taliban does not qualify as a government. They do not qualify to rule the Afghan people. They have not got any legitimacy. And they were asking for the freedom of the women in Afghanistan.
And they weren't just calling for their rights. They were specifically looking ahead to what's happening on Monday, that meeting in Doha of the UN. Tell us a bit more about that.
So this conference happening on this 1st of May is described as an important step towards finding a way how to deal with the Taliban and their ban on women. There was a suggestion by the Deputy Secretary General, Amina Mohammed, at a meeting at University of Princeton in the US, that we might take the baby steps towards the Taliban's recognition. It could be an opportunity, because the Taliban are asking for recognition. And if there is any opportunity to compromise on this, we might be able to solve this problem.
Zia Shahriar. From time to time, we do report on major sporting events from around the world on the Global News podcast. The Sports World programme on the BBC World Service has a very loyal following. And for one man in particular, it has a special meaning. Shahbaz Tasir was kidnapped at gunpoint in Pakistan in 2011 by members of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, or IMU, a Taliban-affiliated Uzbek militant group. He was held in captivity for 5 years. Shahbaz survived his confinement by listening to the BBC World Service, especially Sports World, and following his favourite team, Manchester United. On Saturday, he was invited into the Sports World studio and met the presenter Lee James, one of the voices he had listened to intently during his captivity.
So nostalgic. I'm feeling so emotional. You guys are such an important part of my life and such an important reason for why I'm actually here. And to be here is just surreal. It's almost like a dream come true. So I can't believe it.
As I've said to you before, I find it incredibly humbling to know that you were listening to Sports World, how much it meant to you. You were supporting and following your team, listening to the commentaries, and it kept you going during captivity.
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy when I think about it. I was in solitary confinement and I was being tortured. I had no window. I had no hope. I had nothing to look forward to. And then one day, this militant walks into my cell with a radio And we start listening to Manchester United games. And I wish I could tell you how much it meant to me, how it, you know, gave me something to look forward to. But, you know, your voice, the BBC World Service, just couldn't thank you enough, even if I tried. So you're just such an important part of my life. And I can't believe where I am.
Here we are in the Sports World studio, looking around with the action having gone in the Premier League today. And I suppose we should rewind for people listening to August the 26th, 2011, because you talk about your life. It changed, didn't it? That was an ordinary day for you. You're at home in Lahore with your wife. You'd just returned from a trip to Dubai, and you decided to go into the office that day, as you often do. But then everything changed.
You know, 7 months earlier, my father had been, he was the governor of Punjab, and he was assassinated for standing up for a poor Christian woman. And he was actually fighting for her right to a free and fair trial. And he was killed by his own bodyguard. 7 months later, on my way to work, which should have been just a normal day, I was attacked by about 10 militants and abducted and taken to Waziristan, which is a very lawless region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I was kept there for almost 5 years. It was awful. And just imagine, I used to sit in a room quietly listening to the World Service, following Man United from 2012, 2013, all the way to the 16 season. I say that I never gave up hope, and I didn't. I always knew that I'd come back. But to actually be sitting here right now across you, looking at you, I just, you know, God has been very kind and merciful. I was extensively tortured. It was a very difficult time.
Yeah, that light, I guess, in the very dark times of your life came, as you say, when one of the guards, one of the men that was holding you captive, talked about his love of sport as well. I think he said, you know, brother, are you fond of sports? And you wondered, didn't you, as you say in the book, as to whether this was indeed a trap, whether admitting you supported Manchester United may ultimately prove costly.
There's nothing like a militant asking if you're a Red Devil. So, but, you know, I did. I thought it was a trick question. And usually I had been asked similar questions like that. And every time I answered, say, about my education or my background or things that I enjoyed, I was always told, oh, you're a non-believer, you deserve to be here. So just like that, I presumed, you know, it's another question like that. But because of my love for Manchester United, I said, yes, I do support a football team. I watch Manchester United. And we started having this back and forth where we're trying to confirm that, you know, I'm trying to confirm it's not a trick, and he's trying to confirm it's not just some guy jumping on the bandwagon. And then, you know, we spent, the two of us, the next 3 years in silence, because it was forbidden for him to listen to games as well. So we spent the next 3 years in silence just following Man United. And I have to tell you, except for that 2012 and 2013 season, the rest weren't the best.
Shabazz, thank you so much for coming in.
Lee.
For sharing your story.
Lee. And just before I go, you know, I'm from a CD and Walkman generation, so I'm not even from the radio generation. But I think you don't realize where your reach is and whose heart and life you can touch. And I can never thank the BBC enough, no matter how hard I try. You're just the most amazing people. God bless you all. And thank you for having me. This is such an honor and a privilege to be here after listening to you for so long, to sit across you. It's just an honor. And thank you. Thank you.
The honour is ours. Shabazz Taseer, his memoir of his five-year-long captivity is entitled Lost to the World. A sculpture has been unveiled in Norway in memory of a walrus called Freya, who gained popularity for sunbathing in a fjord, but was then killed by the authorities. Officials said she'd posed a risk to the public, but they were heavily criticised for putting the animal down last August. An online campaign raised $25,000 to create a life-size bronze sculpture of Freya. Eric Holm, who started the campaign for the statue, said he had mixed emotions seeing it in place.
It's really nice, but it's a little sad too. I've seen a lot of people in the audience today in tears, so it's obviously something that means a lot to a lot of people. For me, first of all, it's a statement it makes, both in terms of how we behaved around Freya when she was alive, but also how the authorities took her life.
The sculpture of Freya sits on the rocky shore of the Kongen Marina in Oslo, and yes, of course, I will tweet a picture. A stage play about the late actor Sidney Poitier has just opened in London. Born in the Bahamas,
Poitier was one of the first black actors to become a major Hollywood star, but his journey wasn't easy. Retrograde looks at the pressure the actor faced in the mid-1950s to sever his links to America's growing civil rights movement. Vincent Dowd went to meet the play's author.
Playwright Ryan Calais Cameron wasn't aware of Sidney Poitier until his 20s. Then he caught a couple of iconic Poitier moments, such as Detective Virgil Tibbs slapping a white man in the 1967 film In the Heat of the Night.
There was a time when I could have had you shot.
I'm Ryan Calais Cameron. I'm the writer of Retrograde at the Kiln Theatre in North London. The play is about Sidney Poitier leading a primetime slot on NBC. What happens is he believes that he's coming in to sign a contract for his employment, but actually is told he is on the red list, people that are wanted for an association with Communist Party, and that he has to sign a loyalty oath and do an announcement of one of his most beloved friends if he wants to make it in this industry.
That older friend was Paul Robeson, actor, singer, and campaigner for African-American rights.
Lord God of Abraham.
In 1955, Poitier was cast in the Philco Television Playhouse. Having a central black character was a big step for TV, but this was the era of anti-communist witch hunts, and the play shows Poitier being told to sign a declaration of loyalty to the American way of life.
Studios are adding clauses forbidding actors from committing any offence that will risk public hatred, contempt, or ridicule.
But what has this got to do with me?
You've been associated with people that have questionable characters, politically unacceptable persons.
And what accounts for politically
people
unacceptable...
People that are known for not holding American values.
Aram Ghazouzian wrote a Poitier biography. He says the story Sidney signed up to at NBC, in which he dies in a fight, set a pattern for screen roles which eventually damaged his career.
The television program and the movie that was made after it, called Edge of the City, which was basically the same plot, the same idea, both reaffirm Poitier's emerging image as the black man who is the loyal ally of white society, the black man sacrifice that aids the white person. And this is a common reoccurring pattern in many of Sidney Poitier's films as his career progresses.
He was always somebody that wanted to be a role model to black people coming up. And what happened to Sidney is a new generation of young black people came through and they were like, we don't relate to this black guy in this button-up suit. You saw Sidney just being pushed to the side now, which was absolutely heartbreaking to him.
When in 2001 Sidney Poitier received an honorary Oscar, he paid tribute to black performers before him who'd struggled through the difficult years. Ryan Calais Cameron says not everything has changed.
A lot of us right now will relate to a lot of the hurdles that Sidney is coming up against. It's not just about McCarthyism, it's an whole entire system that he's up against. And a lot of us will relate to that even now, and I think that was the main reason why I really wanted to tell this story.
Ryan Calais Cameron, ending that report by Vincent Dowd. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Stephen Bailey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.